Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. This week we're going city hopping. We've knocked on the doors of key people in different cities and continents around the world and asked them to talk us through how design and architecture are changing the way they live. Coming up on the show, we talk design for social change in Sao Paulo with design curator Adelia Borges.
It's a city in progress, and I think that design is already playing a very interesting role in this situation.
We hear why there's never been a better time to be an architect in Copenhagen from Kent Martinussen of the Danish Architecture Centre.
Only recently have we kind of come back in the game. Have we witnessed it's a kind of revitalization of our heritage?
And we hear how a new generation of forward thinkers are transforming Auckland into a hotbed of design and architecture.
The idea of public promenading, people just outside enjoying space, walking and moving and just hanging out, has been something that hasn't been space available for that in Auckland before.
All that, plus we potter around Paris, wander through Warsaw and hit the beat in Beirut. That's all to come on Section D, right here on Monocle 24. But first, it's time for this week's design news with Gillian De Bias.
Veteran Italian fashion designer Valentino is due to launch a virtual museum next month to showcase his life's work. The godfather of Italian couture recently revealed the plan for a 3D website that will resemble a Roman palazzo with rooms, wings, and galleries. The museum will be launched on December 5th in the form of a downloadable desktop application. The designer has called it his legacy to the younger generation. It's time to rethink the birds and the bees, thanks to a new competition by the Architecture Foundation in London. The project is inspired by In Midtown's initiative to provide beehives and beekeeping training to members of the Business Improvement District in central London. The competition calls for submissions that offer distinctive yet functional designs that help enhance biodiversity in an urban context. The winning proposals will be mass-produced and installed in a variety of sites across the London Midtown area. And finally, fast food giant McDonald's is getting a much-needed makeover in France by designer Patrick Norget. The French designer used birch plywood to create a series of alcoves and seating areas in white with splashes of colour. The home of the McDo is hoping to return to its roots of being a family destination and move away from its current adolescent image.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. What are designers and architects, if not a force for positive change? But both industries have succumbed of late to the murkier perils of superstardom, where fame and fortune on a global scale count more than quality work and respect in local communities. On this week's Section D, I set out to celebrate the people and firms that are bucking this trend around the world. First stop was Sao Paulo. A city so sprawling and chaotic, it's hard to imagine a handful of architects and designers could scratch the surface and make a difference. But, as native design curator Adelia Borges explains, design for progress is very much on the agenda.
This is a daily sight in Brazil's biggest city. Luxury cars inching forward in one of Sao Paulo's infamous traffic jams. But at least these drivers have something nice to look at. Over the years, urban graffiti designs and street art have started to decorate the city's otherwise bland skyscrapers, slowly giving color and personality to what is normally viewed as an ugly city dotted with bland 1950s architecture and overpasses.
It's a city in progress, and I think that design is already playing a very interesting role in this situation.
That's Adelia Borges, a design curator and writer here in Sao Paulo who's been involved in the city's burgeoning design scene since the 1970s. Previously a journalist for one of the city's largest dailies, O Estado de Sao Paulo, Adelia says Brazil's design scene was a late bloomer, with the country only getting its first design school in Rio de Janeiro in the 1960s. But now it's in full bloom, and in Sao Paulo, urban designs can be felt everywhere. But she says it started to gain more recognition when Brazil's middle class hit a growth spurt.
In the last 10 years, We had the population of France, as if it was the population of France that came to the market, that now can buy goods. This improvement of the economical situation and also this improvement of the social situation of our inhabitants are bringing a new face for the periphery, yeah, for the suburbs. So I think that I do think that the main interesting things that are happening in the culture in São Paulo are coming from these fringe areas. Design is related with everyday life of people, and it does interest me. How can you improve the everyday life of ordinary people?
Brazil has one of the largest inequality gaps in the world, with the richest 10% of the population holding just over 44% of the country's wealth. That gap is slowly narrowing as the middle class grows. Design has been one of the key tools for social inclusion in Brazil, as street art and graffiti art in cities like São Paulo, which is typically created by lower and middle classes, are gaining more respect.
Design is not more this thing for the elite of people all over. So we have two or three years ago, Cooper Hewitt Design Museum in New York made a very good exhibition called Design for the Other 90%. It was a wonderful exhibition. And I do think that we have to think about this, how we can improve the life of a majority of people. But we don't have to speak only about design for the other. We have to speak also about design with the other 90%. What we can do together to improve our lives and to improve our design. And also, we have to speak about design by the other 90%, recognizing this very interesting thing that is happening and this inventivity and creativity that is amazing. And we have to know for respecting and recognizing the strength.
In São Paulo, that 90% has tried to get its voice heard through one style of street tagging, better known as pichação, found high on tops of buildings and in places unthinkable for a person to reach. It uses its own style of rigid-like lettering and originated on São Paulo's city streets as a voice for the less advantaged. It was a way of showing officials what they thought, but it's been hard to muster up support.
Our politicians, they don't know yet how design could improve our life and how design could give even a stronger personality to our city. While we don't have this support, this official support, I think that we are seeing very new and strong groups growing and occupying spaces and transforming the city.
But officials have slowly come to realize that no matter how often these designs are washed off, they will always come back. Now, politicians in São Paulo have started to give the city's graffiti scene a legal voice, and they even paid the artist. In the city's north zone between the metro stop Santana and Portuguesa Tietê, the state's Ministry of Culture granted permission to 58 artists to paint 68 pillars under the metro's bridge.
Já tive alguns problemas com a polícia já.
The graffiti artists here tell me that the project was approved by the government after 11 of the artists were arrested for painting graffiti pieces under the same bridge. Now the city plans to keep these pillars painted as an open-air urban art museum, which is actually curated by a gallery, this year by art curator Baixo Ribeiro's gallery, Choque Cultural. And the artists and graffiti pieces will change on a yearly basis. And as Adelia explains, it's not just graphic design where São Paulo is getting its influence from the fringes of the city. Industrial design, too, is starting to pull its influence from the margins of Brazilian society.
Next year, I will be curating a show called Design from Suburb. Design da periferia, as we say in Portuguese. And we are going to show how the poor people in Brazil, even when they are in very difficult situations, they can invent strategies to survive through design. So they can create their own designs for everything they do. So they can invent vending cars for selling popcorns in the street, or they can invent a way to display their products, or they can invent very, very interesting barbecues, grills too. And we are going to have not only from São Paulo, but from these fringe areas from all over the country. And because I do think that it's very interesting for us to give visibility to what is going on.
With the middle class now making up over half of the Brazilian population, it's expected that the design of Brazil's 90% will be felt in more aspects of everyday life, more so than just the commute to work.
That was Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter in Sao Paulo. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Up next, we're heading to Paris. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, Paris may be the city of light, but many would argue it's a city where design and architecture have stood still for too long. Design art galleries and grand civic buildings serve only the top tier of the population. But there are more democratic seeds of change afoot, as Monocle reporter Alexander Orne discovered.
Compared to many other cities, from one year to the next, Paris remains rather true to herself. But as much as Parisians may endlessly call it a gigantic museum, is it really? I guess the person who first coined it a museum must have done so on a Sunday, while almost everyone else lunched away. True, Paris is a museum-like, uniform and rather coherent city, but there is a lot more to be said. Yet, I can't help but wonder, how does it feel to be an architect in Paris? I went to speak with Olivier Marty, who runs with Carl Fournier Studio KO, an architecture firm with offices in Paris and Marrakech.
It's very interesting as a base. You are surrounded since the very beginning. For instance, I was born in Paris, so I've always been surrounded with this landscape, with all those proportions and harmonies that have marked the world between the 17th and the end of the 19th century, which we used to call the classical style and Beaux-Arts style. And it's very interesting because it gives you a culture that's interesting if you can go beyond it. And pretty often to go beyond it, you must go abroad to have other projects and other demands, other clients. But to me, it's a very rich culture to have. When you live in Paris all the time, you sometimes think that it's so classical and boring. And when you go abroad and you see the way people look at you and look at this density and this culture, you figure out that there's something to do with that.
The lack of available space and its historical heritage conditioned the building environment. But can you build something in Paris?
In Paris, the city is so dense with so few empty lands that you don't have the space to build new things. But there are great spaces inside the building that you don't see from outside, which is more like interior design, but that you discover when you enter them. So in Paris, places have so much density. If you buy a restaurant, sometimes there's nothing to keep, but pretty often there's a story, there's a strange material or a strange wallpaper, or there's something to deal with.
Over the last years, there has been some intense discussions around the project called Le Grand Paris. But is there a need for an urban renewal plan?
I think there's a real need to remove the boundaries between central Paris and the little, what we call the first première couronne, petite couronne, which is the first belt around Paris, with cities that used to be the cities where workers used to live, with a very strong history all around of Paris. And this thing of Le Grand Paris is a very big thing. I'm very sad that in the meantime, the mayor of Paris, which have been doing great things apart from that, was building a tram line all around Paris that added another boundary between Paris and this suburb. And that's a shame, because Paris is very small and there are lots of stuff happening all around it with a much bigger freedom, even architecture-wise, design-wise. As for us, for instance, we live in Montreuil, which is a very small Parisian equivalent to Williamsburg, I would say. It's outside of Paris with a few artists, people who don't have the money to have big spaces in central Paris for their studio or their factory or whatever. And I think that there are lots of interesting things happening all around Paris, and I would like things to be more linked between each other. And this idea of Grand Paris could help. Some people think that the future of Paris will be in high rise, which is a bit odd when you know that in the 70s and the 60s, they've built the Tour Montparnasse, which is just a urban nightmare that has destroyed a super quality urban fabric, which was the little artist studios in Montparnasse that no longer exists. And this idea takes us to the debate about the high rise and this project with Herzog and de Meuron, with this pyramid shape, skyscraper or high rise buildings in the periphery of Paris. To me, this is a very false idea of the future. There's another idea that comes as well from the Mary, which is this thing about the Vélib, you know, the Paris, I think, was the first city to do these things with the bike with that scale, by doing it everywhere in a pretty simple way. And I think this direction is more the future. It's not spectacular, it doesn't make amazing pictures, but I think that the future of such a city is more post-crisis than pre-crisis. And all these things of bringing more mobility to the people and changing the way they move in the city is very subtle and maybe more interesting than building high-rises everywhere.
As Olivier Marty talked us through, I wondered, how does Paris influence other creators? On Boulevard Beaumarchais, near République, 2 years ago opened a concept store called Merci. As I got to the address I had written down, I found myself in front of two rather nice looking coffee shops. As I walked in, I was greeted by Jean-Luc Colonna, Merci's managing director, whom I had set out to meet. A bit puzzled, I had to ask him, what is Merci?
Merci is quite an unusual place. We started 2 years ago, and we decided that in Paris we are lacking a big place. It's pretty large, it's 12,000 square feet, where different things and people will encounter thanks to us. That means we like to bring casual things with very sophisticated items, fashionista from the world with local people into the same place. We hate to choose between luxury and everyday life products. And what we did at Merci is to bring very, very edited selection from the very simple, from a very nice pencil at €1, to fantastic leather sofa at €5,000. We don't consider that luxury is a matter of price, but luxury is a matter of selection. What is good for today's life? That's what we are doing here.
Offering a careful selection, mixing old and new, it is a bit like the way we live.
What we have tried to do here is when the people spend 1 hour to come to visit us, we are a destination store. We are not into high street retail street, so it's not the point of what's up today because I just walk in the street and I get into Merci. You take from your time, which is your luxury, 1 hour of your time. Maybe you prefer to play tennis, or maybe you prefer going to the concert. The concept is surprise is a part of the experience. That's why we don't advertise big way. We just say, come on and have a coffee and see what's up. We have a lot of expo. Every 3 weeks we change 100% of the dome here. So that's really the idea of today's shopping is not shopping only. I want you to come here and have a good time at the coffee, have an expo, buy some things, bring your friends, and that's for me the definition of shopping.
So, is there something special about design in Paris?
I believe that the main difference between Paris and the other European cities is the French tends to have a passion for past things, for historical place, for things that they have inherited from their parents or their previous history. And that things compared to Berlin or London, where a lot of people will start with an open page when they start a life, in Paris or in France, people start with something from the past. So they try to mix what they receive from the past, from their childhood or from their parents, with the contemporary things. And that thing, sometimes it's good because it's kind of charm to mix the things. Sometimes it's a little bit passé, that you have to bring your passé when you start your life in your home or things like this. I would say that Paris design scene is very independent. There is no big players, there is a lot of small players, and that may be what is unique to Paris. We have a very small scene of design, but very independent. I think there is a kind of charm to discover something which is kind of low-key, a kind of boutique thing. And for me, in the design, it's not mass. Design is niche, and I like the idea of keeping niches everywhere around the scene of the design.
Merci is an experience. You want to look around, see what you can discover. True, Merci's profit go to charity. But for Jean-Luc Colonna, Merci is about having a good time in a fun and sexy shop. And because we do have a good time and do spend some money, they can distribute their profits to their foundation. From the outside, it may look like a museum, but Paris is far from being lifeless.
That was Monocle reporter Alexander Owen in Paris with Jean-Luc Colonna of Merci and Olivier Marty of Studio KO. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. Next up, we're heading north to Copenhagen.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world, right here on Monocle 24.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
Copenhagen is a role model when it comes to design and architecture. And for a large part, that's thanks to the Danes' attitude towards its architects and designers. To find out more, we headed to the Danish Architecture Centre in Copenhagen to hear from director Kent Martinussen how the city gets it so right.
My name is Kent Martinussen and I'm an architect by profession, but I'm working here as the CEO of the organisation, which is the National Centre for Architecture in Denmark. I think it's really a specific design heritage we have here in Copenhagen and Denmark, Copenhagen in specific. I think the thing is that some 60 years ago, we got quite world famous for doing great design in terms of both building and furnitures. Some of them everybody knows, it's the Arne Jacobsen, the Ant chair and stuff like that. And that kind of made us world famous in design excellence. Behind that design excellence in terms of its aesthetics, there was also a profound understanding of architecture as something that would really feed into society's need for social reforms. So architecture has been in Denmark from the very start of the last century, actually for 100 years from now, has been really socially almost obsessed about how could architecture play a role in really creating better conditions for living in Denmark. So it's a small country, it's a small language, and one of the reasons that we succeeded so well was actually that we were not that many people. So I think there's one thing which is important to add to that, which is that since the 60s and some 30 years ahead, we really had an international standard that was, we were looked upon from all over the world, but then it faded out. And only recently have we kind of come back in the game and have now, primarily within the field of architecture, with people like Bjarke Engelsk from BIC and others doing spectacular buildings and projects around the world, have we witnessed a kind of revitalization of our heritage.
And so what is it like to be a designer or an architect in Copenhagen at the moment?
Somehow you could argue that it's quite wonderful to be a designer or an architect in Copenhagen, because what you have here is that you don't need to persuade neither the public nor the politicians or even professional clients that architecture is important. So in that respect, it's really great. If you talk to a client, he would immediately accept that he needs an architect if he wants to do a new building, which is not the case all over the world.
What defines Danish architecture and what's its appeal abroad then?
I'm totally convinced that it's high skills, competences in terms of sustainability is the main factor at the moment. Second factor is its aesthetics, which is kind of this Scandinavian, Nordic, lightness, minimalistic, natural materials. And the third, I would argue, when you really dig into it, which big clients do, is really the kind of value-based elements such as humanistic tradition, inclusiveness, social involving architecture, creating good apartments for people, creating good institutions for kids and so forth, much more than a lot of, I would argue, countries are used to, where architects are only from the kind of upper end of the market.
How does that differ from other Scandinavian design, other Scandinavian
It really
countries?
Doesn't differ that much, because I think in Norway and Sweden and Finland, we kind of have a mutual culture. So we work together a lot, we work in each other's country, but Denmark is just the country who has the highest amount of architects per capita, and we are really kind of, I wouldn't call it aggressive, but we are really progressive in terms of developing new ideas, new architecture. We are not that, the real difference, it's a good question though, the real difference is that we are more bold than the rest of Scandinavia.
When was the height of Danish architecture and what defined that period?
I would like to define it right now as it is, because there has never been an international demand for Danish architecture and design as high as it is right now. But the fact is, the truth is, that if you're talking about the pinnacle of our global brand value, I think that was in the 60s, for a reason which has to do not so much with the quality of what we did at that time, but more the fact that there was not so much design in the world at that time. So now the competition has been much more tough, so we find it harder to really to battle through. But certainly the demand is much bigger. The biggest Danish projects abroad are actually hospitals and institutions in the UK, in Germany. And right now, you know that BIG is doing something in New York. Some of the old and Eastern European countries, Russia and so forth, are coming up. So actually the biggest build projects are in Europe. But what is happening is that the biggest demand is actually from the BRIC countries, from the new markets.
That was our managing editor, David Michon, in Copenhagen. And next up, we're heading to Warsaw. Stay tuned.
Londonborg, as a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, es a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London, cala. Monocle 24 des.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, τέμα on Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, μπουρσε Monocle 24.
Λόντον καρά, Monocle 24.
Cities destroyed during the Second World War have been rebuilt with mixed success. Too often, for sake of speed and necessity, vast swathes of dense, low-rise, cheap housing turned once charming cities into depressing urban jungles. 80% of Warsaw was left uninhabitable by 1945, but after nearly a century, the city is having a renaissance.
People who've never been to Warsaw assume the city is filled with faceless communist-era buildings. But the Polish capital has a very particular character. It's about more than just concrete giants or replicas of pre-war architecture. Warsaw, like so many cities that have been rebuilt in the post-war period, has an eclectic mix of old and new. I met with Grzegorz Piątek, architecture critic and curator, in his apartment in a modernist 1930s building that survived World War II.
We're in a building built in 1937. All the new technology, so we have lifts.
Grzegorz, so what is the short history of Warsaw's architecture and design?
The history of architecture in Warsaw started anew in 1945. This is where the city started anew and had to reinvent itself because it was 80% of the buildings were destroyed in the war. Out of the 1.3 million original inhabitants, only 200,000 returned after the war. So both the built substance and the social fabric of the city had to be constructed anew, not just reconstructed. Warsaw is essentially a 20th century city, even though it was founded in 14th century. But there is very little left of the original medieval or Baroque or 19th century architecture. There is, of course, the old town, but it is a complete creation from the 50s. It's rather a scientific fantasy on what the old town was before, rather than a faithful reconstruction. It is the post-war planning and post-war architecture that shapes the structure and the spirit of the city now, the 50s, 60s, modernist architecture, Stalinist architecture, and of course the most recent development. Warsaw is a very open city. It has a lot of empty space, both physically and mentally. There's a lot of gaps to be filled, a lot of infrastructure to be built. After 89, when foreign capital started to pour in and new materials became available, Warsaw became a big playground for developers, for both local and international architects. So we are now witnessing maybe a renaissance, but definitely a redefinition of what Warsaw is right now.
I walk through the parks of Warsaw with Bartek Kraciuk and Norbert Rettke, artists, entrepreneurs, and owners of Warsaw's hotspots, like the popular Warszawa Powiśna.
There was a lot of really well-designed infrastructure in this city that was built during communism, when there was not enough money or even technologies to build it well. A lot of them are underrun, don't necessarily meet practical criteria that the building has to have to be usable. They come from that bad era.
Which our parents hated. Yeah. Because the previous system was connected with those buildings. So yeah. Our parents are too old to see the beauty of it. And we're young enough to see the beauty and old enough to have power and money to create something new and really magic.
Could you tell me a little bit about background of Warsaw's architecture and places, like why they are the way they are?
It's a city of absurd. It was almost completely destroyed during the Second World War. So there was nothing left. Small part of it, the old town, was rebuilt. So it's actually a new old town, which is a paradox. And then a lot of it was not built again. Torn down, the new communist ideology took over, bringing some really, really great modernist structures that are so hated because they were part of the system, and also a lot of gray, not so interesting buildings that didn't really pass the test of time. And oh, and then another crisis was 90s.
Before the 90s, they had really great concept, but they didn't have enough money and manpower to build it.
And then the 90s came, and they covered everything in styrofoam and painted it salmon pink or pistachio green. And then some new capital came in, and they built some horrible office buildings and also apartment buildings. And now we're left with this mess, but it seems that some people have learned some things.
With this mess, without city center, which right. A city center in which there are no people from Warsaw,
yeah.
And with an old town where nobody goes, without a place where people meet. During the last 10 years, I think, something started in the city and young people started to create new places and new routes for the city, because before it was completely blue and really not interesting.
Yeah, so we have this absurd, messy structure. Well, it's a really random structure.
The structure was quite okay, but in the 90s, we were like, hey, hooray, we're so USA. Let's build everything everywhere and let's make it pink.
Yeah, that's kind of what it was. So that's what we're left with. But you really can find some amazing opportunities in this absurd, because absurd is amazing in a way.
I met with architect Aleksandra Wasilkowska in her workshop, a narrow space built to fit tightly between two buildings. Could you tell me how Warsaw differs from other cities?
I don't think that Warsaw differs from other cities. I think it's a strange hybrid between West and East, and some kind of organism that's struggling between their own ambitions and his own energy. So I think we are somewhere between Paris and Moscow.
Could you tell me about the energy of Warsaw as a city?
Warsaw is driven by enthusiasm of young people who believe that anything can be done. The potentiality of the space and everything that we dream about in the past and is not built. So this is this idea of the future is something which forms Warsaw.
And on a more contemporary level, Warsaw is interesting, first of all, because of the tension between the permanent and the temporary spaces, the relationship between the two. Warsaw still has very few formal, finished public spaces. So there's a lot left to be done, which opens a lot of possibilities. It doesn't limit your imagination. It's not like being in Florence or in other Polish cities that are pretty much finished.
That was Monocle reporter Gabriela Buczek in Warsaw. Now, culturally, they may be poles apart, but Warsaw and Beirut have faced a similar predicament. How to conserve a rich heritage whilst paving the way for a new generation of designers and architects with their own identity. In Beirut, architect Gregory Gatzeralia has opened a space in the city's meatpacking district to incubate the city's young creatives.
Why open a design gallery when you're also very busy with your main job, which is an architect?
I think it's always, there's no time to open a gallery. I think, on the contrary, I think it's very adequate as a timing because people needs to be entertained. We're fed up of all the whatever the stress, the situation, the regional situation, the look. But I think people need to see other things, see that their lives goes on, see beautiful stuff happening, etc. I think it was the perfect timing.
An avid collector, Gazzarella opened his gallery to show his own pieces, believing this was the only way to be taken seriously. But most importantly, he did it to showcase local Lebanese design.
When we opened, I started to introduce or to present my private collection that I've been gathering for years. But I'm much more interested now in the contemporary design, the international designer and mostly the local one.
You just mentioned Lebanese designers. Can you tell us a little bit, how's the scene here? Who are your favorite designers in Lebanon? Is it a growing scene of designers?
Absolutely. I think they're very interesting. A lot of them study in the best schools in Europe and in the States. Unfortunately, when they come back, they don't have the same backing technologically. So we have to be very traditional in the way we build, not on the way we think. And that's what I think start to make the local design very interesting because it's more the thoughts than just the material. I thought it was the negative part of the local design, but it tend to be, I think, the nice part of the local design because we don't need local Zaha Hadid the pieces and we don't need Philip Stark sort of. No, we need the locals. We need them to work with our heritage, our way of doing things and do it differently.
So let's talk a little bit about the current exhibition where you basically went to the Beirut flea market and you found all these legs of public benches.
Yeah.
And then you asked maybe a dozen local designers, but not only designers, photographers, all sorts of artists to come up with a design using the feet of these benches.
The idea was when I discovered those legs, I said, okay, I will use them for my own project, but obviously. But I was touched by what I felt looking at them, and a bench of a public garden portrays so many emotional things. I mean, the lovers and the homeless who sleeps on it, the old guy who rethink about his whole life, and the spies that exchange the documents and etc. But I cannot tell, or I didn't want to tell myself all the stories, so I said I will tell my friends and from different walk of life, whatever artist or etc., if they have an idea, what is those bench legs portrayed for them. And I gave to 16 different person, and it's amazing to see how 16 different minds go in all over the places, and this is what's great about the show.
Cattarella's emotional link to design has not stopped him from understanding the local market. In a way, he's been nurturing clients through his architectural practice. Do you think the Lebanese customers are now really open to design or willing to spend money for it?
Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of, and I can notice that even some of my clients who used to be very much into the 17th century, etc., are coming, but with conviction, to the world of the modern art and design, etc. And I travel with them, I show them pieces, and they see that there are real artists behind it. There are real thoughts, and that can only touch and only provoke things. And they start to compare. I'm not diminishing the past, on the contrary, I think each those guys in the 17th modern were modern for their time. They've created proportion, they've created everything. But things has to move on. People has to see that there's progress. We cannot just stall on one period. And this is the beauty. We should always respect the past and always push the adventure of art, etc.
There's no doubt Gazzarella wants to showcase the best of Lebanese design across the world. Next March, the popular regional Art Dubai Fair will devote a special area for design. And Gazzarella, with a handful of Lebanese designers, will be there.
We are there with the greatest European galleries like Carpenter's Workshop, Cairo, etc. So we have to really position ourselves and we have to really show what we can do. And I think we have the potential and the people to do. It's a great opportunity to show what Beirut is all about, this creative energy that we have.
That was Monocle correspondent Carol Corm in Beirut with architect Gregory Gazzarella. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We're off to Auckland next, but first, a short break. We'll be back in a moment.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time, and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, as cities go, particularly the ones we've been to today, Auckland is relatively new, just 170 years old, in fact. And, despite a brief flirtation with modernist architecture in the 1960s, it's remained rather conservative, wedded to its Victorian origins. Pretty and friendly, but perhaps a little bit dull. But this is changing, as Monocle reporter Federico Monsalve found out.
For years now, architectural heritage has prided itself mainly on its Victorian ancestors. and only just now are Kiwis beginning to pay close attention to the efforts of modernists from the 60s and 70s. Likewise, and perhaps thanks to a change in local government strategies for project competition, young, promising architects are being given incredible opportunities to dream about the future of their city and build it. With us now are two directors of one such firm, Ferran and Hay.
So I'm Jeff Ferran.
And I'm Tim. We're lucky enough to sort of travel a lot with work in different countries, and we enjoy that stimulation. But I think we both agree that Auckland is a fantastic place for us to base our practice. We love the environment. We love the opportunity that we now see for the city. So we are quite focused on making sure, however we can, that those opportunities are not squandered.
The Auckland area is divided in very distinct regions. The luscious west, full of forests and mountains. The east, increasingly attracting model homes and recent immigrants. The south, with its industrial aspirations and Pacific Island population. And the north, with its attractive beaches and leafy suburbs. Likewise, the central city has developed in pockets with very distinct personalities, populations, and retail experiences.
But basically, Auckland is arranged around sort of the central Queen Street Valley, which is the main street running roughly sort of north-south and heading north to the water, which for Auckland is a good thing in the southern hemisphere. But you've got ridges either side of that, and the main central business area is sort of clustered around that point. And on either side of those spines, you've got finer grain streets such as High Street, Elliott Street, Lawn Street, and those precincts on either side of the main thoroughfare of Queen Street have traditionally been that of the sort of the boutique shopping, a lot of high-end fashion outlets in High Street. But these pockets they sit in isolation. You know, you might think that you start off on a Saturday morning and go for a wander around High Street and have a look at some beautiful New Zealand fashion and then think about somewhere to go for lunch, and there you'd stop because there was no offering in the central city that would really work for lunch on a Saturday. Whereas now, you know, you can make your way down to the water, engage in that edge, or even find some better opportunities that have been opened up in the central city, really embracing the kind of urban fabric.
For some time now, local government has been consulting and preparing a vision for the Auckland of the future. The chosen model is loosely based on the European concept of shared spaces, a move that seems to be aimed at stitching all of central Auckland's distinct but somewhat isolated precincts.
One of the projects we haven't been involved with, but I think is one of the most successful things to happen in Auckland for a long time, is the conversion of some of the smaller streets to the shared space initiative in the city, and not just the actual detail or the strategy of shared space itself, but the placement of those means that you can now walk from some fairly signature projects in Auckland. You can find your way down through the lanes and through High Street and through the sort of fashion district, and basically leapfrog from one public space to the next, all the way down through another regeneration project, the Britomart precinct, and find your way down to the water. And to actually be able to bounce from one part of the town and without really realizing it, find yourself in a completely different part of the town and be engaged as a pedestrian the whole way. It seems like a really simple thing, but that just hasn't really been possible in Auckland until these type of things have been unlocked.
Recently, one of the most impressive and undoubtedly largest and most expensive urban renewal projects in Auckland has been the Wynyard Quarter, a former industrial seaside space which still retains elements of its rougher past. Over there, we have corrugated iron structures. There are sea containers stacked one on top of each other, and a series of long and tall sheds which now contain bars, restaurants, and even an Italian ice cream parlor. This is almost a postmodern exercise, and super yachts sit beside fishing vessels. There's an old refurbished tram which shares space with pedestrians and even children fishing off the wharf. This space was also spearheaded by Ferran and Hay.
Wynyard Quarter has historically been a marine industry sort of area. It's been petrochemical. It's a waterfront site that has basically been a storage depot for fuel. And suddenly those tanks have been removed and a large chunk of the waterfront's been opened up to the public. I mean, for people that haven't been to Auckland, assume, you know, Auckland's a waterfront-based city. But the waterfront has been sort of dominated by the port, which takes up a large frontage, and then obviously this to the west, this petrochemical area. So the pockets of public interaction with the waterfront edge has actually been very limited. It's doubled this year, really, with the sort of unlocking of the Wynyard Quarter and the sort of connection by bridge of the sort of waterfront axis. So it feels like a fairly obvious move to make now that it's unlocked and it's open, and something that we'd enjoyed a lot when we travelled overseas to other cities. Like, we've also been to Barcelona a couple of times over the last few years, and the idea of public promenading, people just outside enjoying space, walking and moving and just hanging out, has been something that hasn't been space available for that in Auckland before.
But does that mean that local architecture in this young city is still outward looking? Or can one perhaps start to speak of a distinctive Auckland design, of a specific urban vernacular or even a heritage fabric that is distinctive from its colonial past?
Some people are passionate about building an identity within New Zealand design. I think we feel that there is a very strong approach that is recognisable from a New Zealand designer. We resist the idea of a physical categorisation, and I think, you know, quite often can be criticized for sort of the looking further afield for our influences. But you respond to your environment, right? So like, and we are in New Zealand and often working on New Zealand sites and in the New Zealand landscape or urban context, and our response is specific to that particular context. So by definition, it is specific to a New Zealand design or style.
In a way, this 170-year-old city is a civilized wild, wild west. Developers are not exactly wielding guns and exchanging real estate at a local saloon. But as Auckland continues to feature as one of the most livable cities in the world, as local governments make efforts to bring out thought-out strategies to fruition, the city's spring is suddenly more fertile for passionate designers and architectural young guns.
There's some big pockets of the city that are up for grabs. And there's some big strategies within the city which could go any number of ways, which could completely change the face of how we move through the city or engage with its components.
That was Monocle reporter Federico Monsalve in Auckland with native architecture practice Fearon Hay. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week on Section D. Next week, we'll be looking at the modernist furniture market, going Dutch with graphics, and talking African architecture with David Adjei. Tune in at 1900 hours on Tuesday the 29th to hear more. But for now, goodbye.